Hello, this is Scott Jose, Director of the Center for Excellence in Preaching at Calvin Theological Seminary in Grand Rapids, Michigan. You're about to hear a sermon by Dr. Lewis B. Smeeds. Years ago, Lou Smeeds taught at Calvin College in Grand Rapids, Michigan, but he spent most of his career as professor at Fuller Theological Seminary in Pasadena, California. Dr. Smeeds is widely known for many of his wonderful books, including Forgive and Forget, Caring and Commitment, Shame and Grace, Sex for Christians, as well as many, many others. Over the years, one of Dr. Smeeds' favorite topics was that of hope. In the sermon you're about to hear, you'll recognize the fact that Dr. Smeeds thought long and hard with the concept of hope, how desperately we need it in our broken world, how difficult it can be to maintain hope, and yet how hope is indeed a gift of God. Early in the sermon, he thunders with that wonderful voice of his, "Keep hoping, keep hoping, keep hoping." I pray that this sermon will help you do just that.
I want you all to know that for me, standing in this great pulpit is a very special gift. I hope it turns out to be a small gift to you too. I have just one thing I want to say to you. It's the same thing I say to myself whenever I worry about my kids and watch the evening news. It's don't give up hope. Keep hoping. Keep hoping. Keep hoping. I want to begin by recalling a fairly well-known Greek myth about the ancient god Zeus, a pesky, kind of feisty old god stewing and brewing up at the top of Mount Olympus, really angry at a colleague god named Prometheus. Prometheus had created the world and all the males in it, so Zeus set about creating with some colleagues an absolutely beautiful female whom he named Pandora. And somehow or other, through a complicated maze of circumstances, Pandora was given a box to bring down to the Valley of the Mortals with one warning: don't peek. Well, you know what happened. She pried open the cover, and out swarmed a slew of slithering, terrible, ugly, evil, tragic things that were bound to cause a lot of trouble and a lot of suffering. But one thing was left in the box. Hope was the one thing they had. There's another version of the same myth, according to which the box is pried open by Pandora, and out flew a beautiful array of everything that is good and lovely and beautiful and true, everything that a mortal would want and need for her own fulfillment. But they flew just out of reach. One thing left in the box: hope. You get the picture that they're trying to tell us that human existence is lived on a journey, on a slippery slope, with the good and lovely and beautiful things we need and want for our fulfillment up at the crest, and all the ugly, terrible things that cause us to suffer down below. And so we're all trying to keep our balance on the slippery slope, and what keeps us moving is hope. St. Paul had the same vision. In a passage that was read and preached on so beautifully by Gary Hall here a few weeks ago, in Romans 8, St. Paul says this: we are saved by hope. Saved by hope? Difficult sentence to translate, evidently, because it varies with each translation. Some of the translations have, we're saved, but all we've got to show for it so far is hope. Another version has it, we hope we're being saved. So take your pick. They all come down to the same thing. Salvation, when we have it, will be the fulfillment of our very being. But none of us has made it yet. We're on the way on the slippery slope, and it's a struggle, and it's hope that saves us and keeps us going. I want to talk about hope for a little while with you this morning. And I want to hang my thoughts on four P's. Here they are. Passion, power, pain, and providence. Passion, power, pain, and providence. Hope, said Kierkegaard, is passion for the possible. We're talking serious hoping here, friends. We're not talking about hoping that the Dodgers will win today or other things that don't affect us deeply. We're talking about hoping for stuff in which we are deeply invested. We're talking about passion. There are three ingredients to the making of a passion, and a passion that's a hope for things that you want that may be but may not be. The first ingredient is imagination. Nobody ever hoped for anything without first having a dream about what it was like, would be like if it came true. You've got to dream. You've got to keep dreams alive. But dreams are not enough. One of my favorite fantasies when I was a boy was that I was playing first base for the Detroit Tigers. My gangly arms could scoop up any ground ball between first and second. At the last of the ninth, two out, bases loaded, count 3-2 on me, I always hit a homer. Beautiful fantasy. But I never had any hope that it would come true. I was a lousy ball player. I never believed that it could come true. And that's the second ingredient. You've got to believe that what you hope for is possible. That's not enough either. I plan to retire next year. I want to do that. And Doris and I want to go over to Europe and spend some time, walk in Cambridge, walk in Regis's pathway there, and see if he's left a few crumbs of wisdom around for me. We can imagine it, and we can believe it, but it's not a hope. Shoot, we could live and die in Pasadena and be perfectly happy. We don't have any real investment in it for ourselves. I can tell you something that I am invested in. I'm invested in my kids. I want, with a passion, for them to live productively, happily, and godly. I want them to be good people and successful people. My friends tell me I'm neurotic about it. Okay, I am. But it's a passion. Because I'm invested in it, I can imagine, I can believe, and I'm invested in it. It's a passion. For the possible. What's your passion? What's your passion? The great thing about passion is that it becomes the most productive energy of all human life. Hope is what makes things go. I once taught a course over at Fuller on Christianity and political change, and I learned one thing from teaching that course. People do not change things because they're hungry. People don't change things because they're poor. People don't change things because they're oppressed. People change things when they get hope that they don't have to be poor, don't have to be hungry, don't have to be oppressed anymore. Hope is what changes things, and hope keeps people alive and going. I was just reading a Jewish philosopher just yesterday afternoon, and this sentence caught my attention. He said, "Do you wonder how it is that the Jewish people stay alive in spite of all the exile, in spite of the Holocaust, in spite of everything?" I can tell you in one word, it's hope. It's hope. It's hope. Oh, we have not begun to fathom the motivating power of hope. It even affects our bodies. Psychologists tell us that it improves our immune system. Makes us more resistant to the common cold. Norman Cousins hung around the UCLA Medical Center for a decade, and at the end, he talked about a biology of hope. People with cancer have a better chance if they hope. And if they die, they at least live better while they're alive. I can tell you that no painter has ever put her brush to canvas. No enterpriser has ever struck out on a new endeavor. No writer has ever put a pen to paper unless she or he had hope that something could come of it. The trouble is that as powerful as hope is, it does have limits. I have a friend who is a cancer specialist, an oncologist, and a very good one, and he's a wonderful human being, but somewhat crusty, a little arrogant, maybe. And I asked a friend of his who was in church here this morning why this man had to sound so tough when he had a tender heart. And his friend said, in his line of medicine, you've got to be tough. 90% of his patients die. I said, I think he's off by 10%. And that's where the pain comes. Hope can break your heart. It's a risk to hope. I want to tell you a story. It's a rather personal story, and some of you will think maybe it's inappropriate in an Episcopalian pulpit to get so personal. But at my age, I don't care. I don't care what you think. It's my story. I'm going to tell it. Doris and I spent the first decade of our marriage hoping to have a child. We hoped, we prayed, we hoped, and we prayed, and then for a while we just hoped. After 10 years, miracle, she got pregnant. You see, never stop hoping. About the 6th month, one night, something went wrong, and I rushed to the telephone to call her doctor, and the doctor said, she's going to labor. Something broke in there. Get her to the emergency room as fast as possible. I'll be there to meet you. But I've got to tell you this. Your child is going to be seriously malformed. Tell Doris about it on the way. Great conversation. We said to ourselves, we can take it, it'll be okay, but we're going to hope. We're not going to give up hope. We're not going to give up hope. 6 a.m., the doctor came into the waiting room where I was waiting and doing my hoping. He had a silly grin on his face. He said, Lou, congratulations. You have a perfect man-child. And I went to look at the baby through those glass windows. He looked just like me. Perfect, indeed. And I went to Doris and I say, you see, you see, you see, you must never give up hope, never give up hope. 2 days later, the baby was dead. Hope can break your heart. We could have a testimony meeting here this morning, at least those of us who've lived a while, and share moments of a hope that broke our heart. And that's the time you have to ask, if that hope, that high hope, crashed on the hard rocks of reality, is there still another? I have a dear friend, his name is Tammy Kramer, who directs the outpatient AIDS clinic at the county hospital. She told me of a young man who had been coming in regularly for about a year, year and a half. And this day, he got a new doctor. And this doctor felt obliged to look him in the eye and say, you must be prepared, you'll be dead within the year. And he told Tammy on the way and said, on his way out, he said, she took away my hope. She took away my hope. And Tammy said, yes, it may be time to find another. Is there another? Is there? We enter the biblical terrain of life and discover that hope gets transformed, gets taken up on new terms. Almighty God comes in, the maker of the universe comes in, and hope changes from being a passion for the possible to being a passion for his promise. And that makes it big. It also makes it riskier. There are, I think, two basic promises in the Bible. One is the promise of a happy ending. in the end, when finally the world works right, the other is the promise that God will be with us while we're still trying to keep our balance on the slippery slope between suffering and joy. That happy ending, you go to heaven. Trouble is, you've got to die first. And I don't find in all reality an awful lot of passion for that. I once taught at a Christian college, and I asked students, how many of you want to go to heaven when you die? Heaven by a landslide. How many of you would like to go tomorrow if you could? Not a lot of passion. So I changed the terms of the question. I said, how many of you would like to wake up tomorrow in a world where children can play on any street at night and never be afraid? How many of you would like to wake up tomorrow in a world where nobody ever pointed a gun at another human being? How would you like to wake up in a world where nobody put other people down because of their color or their gender or their sexual orientation? How many of you would like to live in a world where no mother ever mourns a hungry child and no father ever mourns a dead son? And how many besides would like to enter that kind of a world, free, free at last, to hear the music they've never heard before, to see beauty they've never seen before, to experience the fullness of the being that God intended them to be? How many of you would like to enter that world on those terms tomorrow? And they all raised their hands, and I said, in that case, you want to go to heaven tomorrow. But it's not yet. God knows it's not yet. The Redeemer has come, but the world isn't redeemed by a long shot. There was a rabbi, an ancient rabbi, who moved to Jerusalem because he wanted to be in Jerusalem when the Redeemer came and the world was redeemed. So he took an apartment and waited for the trumpet blast from Mount Olivet that was supposed to signal the coming of the redeemed world. One morning he was awakened by the shrill blast of a trumpet, and he ran to his window. Hallelujah, the world is redeemed. And he looked out of the window and saw a man beating a donkey. And he sighed and he said, as long as there is a man beating a donkey, the world isn't redeemed. Well, I can tell you, as long as there are adults beating children and children beating adults, the world is not redeemed. We're still on the slippery slope. And that brings the second hope. The hope is that wherever you are in your journey, wherever you are on that climb, wherever you are when you're slipping down, that God will be with you. That's the real promise. You remember Moses and the burning bush? God beckoned Moses close to him, and Moses didn't know who in the world he was. And God said, I want to get my romance with the human family on track again, and I want you to be my point man. And Moses said, who are you? What's your name? And God says, you want to know my name? Listen carefully, because my name tells you who and what I am. Listen, the one who will be there with you in my fashion. The one who will be there with you always in my fashion. The promise is encouraging that in my fashion is catch 22. Because it feels very often if he's not here at all. At least he feels that way to me sometime. Simon Wiesenthal tells of hearing a Jewish lady praying in the ghetto. And it went like this. Almighty God, maker of the universe, you get back down here where you belong and tend to your business. Jacques Ellul, great French theologian, said this. He said, I believe that God has abandoned us. I believe that God has abandoned us. And hope is our way of demanding that he come back from leave of absence. We live in a world where God's presence in his fashion is so tantalizing, so empty, so weak to us sometimes. Can you really hope if you can't be sure God is here? I want you to think of the cross. I want you to think of the cross of Jesus Christ. I want you to think of a man, the brightest and best of all the ages. I want you to think of a man who had been walking about doing good, filled with God as no other human being had ever been. And now he was at the most God-forsaken, hopeless moment of his life. If there ever were a moment when you could be sure God was not there, it was then. And Jesus himself knew it. He didn't say, "I wonder where God is." All he said was, why have you forsaken me?" But then a couple of days later, as the fingers of the light were filtering through the mist of Joseph's garden, before the citizens of the city had caught their second snooze, the God who seemed so absent came alive, and there was a resurrection. A resurrection. Hopelessness must be the time when hope is revived. Because he was there, but in his fashion. And his fashion, when people suffer, is to be part of the suffering. God isn't only the God of the suffering. God is the suffering God. And there's the hope. Because he comes alive in resurrection. He comes alive again and again and again. So keep on hoping. Keep on hoping. In just a few moments, some ordinary people are going to be handing you a little wafer and a goblet. It's been done for ages. I hope that you will sense at that moment that God is saying to you, keep on hoping, keep on hoping. If you wonder whether your marriage is going to make it, keep on hoping, keep on hoping. If you're lonely and a desperate need of somebody to be close to, keep on hoping, keep on hoping. If you're worried about your kids and wondering what they're up to or what they're thinking, keep on hoping, keep on hoping. If you wonder whether the rest of the world will ever consider you as precious to God as anybody else, keep on hoping, keep on hoping. If you wonder whether this world is ever going to work right again, keep on hoping, keep on hoping. Keep on hoping. Keep on hoping.